Welcome to Conductor's Brew. I am Larry Spell and joined as always by my friend and co-host Matt Vanilla. Today though, we are in Zoom land. Matt, how you doing over there?
You know, I'm all right, Larry. Thanks for asking. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's kind of cold. That's why we're not in the front yard today because, you know, it's April 14th and it was snowing earlier today.
It was snowing, yeah, really just about an hour ago. Yeah, it's like in the 30s and rainy. It's not a pleasant day outside, but, you know, that's how it goes here in Utah. It's very kind of back and forth here in April.
It always seems like it's going to snow on tax. It always snows on tax day or right around it. It's the weirdest thing. And then next week it'll be
it
like...
I hope it doesn't this year because tax day is May 15th this year.
That's true. Actually, it's 17th. You got two more days.
Pardon me. May 17th.
There you go.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah.
But better early than late. But yeah, no, I hope it doesn't actually snow on real tax day or the extended tax day this year. But traditional tax day, yes, we normally get snow. So yeah, we're inside, we're Zooming, and that's okay, because we're also Zooming in crew member Matt McKeever. McKeever, how are you doing over there in Cheesetown?
I'm doing well, and thanks again for the reminder, I guess, of what the week is, you know, April 14th. If it's all right with you all, I'd like to give a little early birthday shout out to my mother, whose birthday is tomorrow.
Oh, your mom's born on tax day.
Happy birthday, Matt's mom.
And
indeed.
You know, fun thing with her this weekend is she's actually giving her solo debut with the Bozeman Symphony. This is the first time that they are back with a minimal in-person audience.
Nice.
You know, since everything closed down with, you know, the pandemic. This is also, I think, the first live concert that they're doing with their new music director. And
who is that? Do you know?
His name is Norman Wynn.
Mm-hmm.
Peabody guy. He's also the assistant or associate at Oregon. I'm really looking forward to hearing my mom play some Bach.
Okay, I was going to say, what's she playing?
She's doing the orchestral suite.
Oh, nice. Well, very cool. Well, congratulations to your mom on the birthday and the upcoming performance. That's pretty awesome.
What's your mother's name?
Sue McKeever.
Sue, break a leg. Best wishes.
Yeah.
Hope it goes well.
Thanks, y'all.
Looking forward to hearing about it.
Absolutely. Well, that's cool. And also a note here. Today is Wednesday. We normally aren't broadcasting our show on Wednesday. We normally do Friday. And that's because the vaccines have been coming around. And
that's my fault. Yeah.
Well, it's all right, man. You know, Matt got the vaccine and got the vaccine droop.
Yeah, I got my vaccine almost a week ago, the Johnson & Johnson, and I'm still tired. And I woke up Saturday morning, we're going to do our show, and I thought, nope, there's no way. I can't even see straight. Well, not literally, but it was hurting. It felt like I've been recovering from the flu for about a week straight, which is starting to wear thin, to say the least.
Well, I can imagine.
But there's nothing like a nice warm cup of tea or a hot beverage of some sort to comfort one, to soothe one's soul,
yes,
whilst recovering from a vaccine.
Yeah. So,
shot.
So what's your brew over there?
All right. Well, today I've already imbibed a significant amount of caffeine simply to be able to keep my eyes open, and I thought, you know, why don't I not overdo it? And so I pulled out some tea that is a nice kind of wintry day tea. So it's perfect for today. I've had it before in the show. It's a smoked black tea, and it just smells so good. It sort of reminds me of campfire, and it's almost like if you made non-alcoholic Scotch whiskey tea.
Oh man, that sounds pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's really quite tasty. Very mild, but also it has a pungent note without being bitter at all. So that's what I'm sipping on right now. What about you all? What you got there?
Yeah, what you got, McKeever?
Well, in honor of 414 Day, which is today, which is Milwaukee Day, since that is our area code.
Okay, I was about to ask, what is the significance? Okay.
And I guess, you know, now I have officially...
Wait, so is this actually a real thing, or are you just making this up?
No, it's a real thing.
That's the thing they do in Milwaukee?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I guess now I have officially, you know, given up on my undisclosed location. I am drinking Stone Creek's The Good Land, those of you who have seen Wayne's World will understand the reference.
Milwaukee.
And it is a, you know, it's their spring blend, medium roast, you know, with some juicy and citrus notes, and just really quite tasty.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So this 4-1, so that's, I guess, the kind of the older. I imagine Milwaukee's got more than one area code at this point, but that was kind of the original, you know, the heart and soul of it all.
I believe so. You know, it's kind of like the 312 for Chicago.
The 803 here in Salt Lake. We have the 803 beer from Uinta. That's what that's all about. So, anyway. Well, I thought
a different type of
I thought it was 801. It's not 801. Is 801 beer?
I think it's 801. Maybe it's 801. Maybe it is 801. I don't know what 803 is.
What's 803? I don't know.
I think I'm making that up. Yeah, I think it's 801. Oh my gosh, they might ask me to leave now. I got the area code wrong. But in my defense, I have my cell phone from North Carolina. I have a solid 252 Eastern North Carolina area code. No beers, no days. That's not a day. There's no day of February 52nd. So yeah, we just got nothing. But anyway, okay. So yeah, you're right. It's 801. But yeah, you went to 801 beer.
Back in my beer drinking days, I quite enjoyed the 801. I think it was a Pilsner, wasn't it?
It's a Pilsner, yeah, from Uinta. One of their favorites that I one of theirs that is my favorite. I should put it that way. That and Golden Spike. That's a really good one from Uinta.
A beer show. I don't care if I can't drink it. I'll just sip it and spit it out like during a wine tasting or something.
Oh yeah. Well, this is the gluten, but you can drink something else. Do they have gluten-free beers?
Oh, you know, they do. I haven't tried many, but I've really gotten into cider.
Ooh, there you go.
There's some really good cider breweries, or do you call them breweries if they're making cider?
Cideries? Like, I don't know.
What? Yeah. The cider in Utah is pretty good. So okay. I can take us through that if we want to.
I'm a huge fan of cider. So yeah, let's have a cider show. That sounds like a pretty good plan. But you got to get over your post-vaccine funk before you do that.
Yeah,
you'd probably lay out if you didn't.
With our mask mandate ending here April 10th, and it being extended in the city of Salt Lake City,
yeah,
the statewide mandate was lifted, but the city mandate is in effect.
Right.
I think it'll be a while still until we can sort of sit and chat in a brewery or a pub.
Yeah. When does
we're getting closer.
When does your J&J vaccine, when do they say that's fully effective?
4 weeks.
Four weeks?
May 7th, yeah. Oh. I mean, if you do the math, it's still at least a week faster than the next fastest.
The Pfizer, yeah.
Yeah, the Pfizer and the Moderna, it's like 3 or 4 weeks in between, and then 2 weeks between shots, and then 2 weeks after the final shot, you're fully protected. So I'm still ahead of the game, but man, it's... I don't know. I don't want to know what getting COVID feels like if this is what the vaccine feels like.
Yeah, fair enough. And I got the Pfizer, and I was fine after the first one. The second one, I had some reactions due to some chills. But I'm now past my second. Tuesday was 2 weeks past my second shot, so I'm now into the fully vaccinated thing. And I'm going around. I'm licking like handrails and letting people spit in my face. No, I'm just kidding.
You know, you could. Then congratulations, you old man. You got to go before us.
Hey, come on now. Not because I'm old. I'm not that old. Wasn't in like the 70 plus category. Thank you very much. Anyway, but yes, no, I was past that, but I've got my first one at the beginning of March. So beginning of March to the middle of April. So it's a process. And McKeever, are you past your 2 weeks yet? Are you?
Tomorrow's the day.
All right. Well, there you go. Well, we can celebrate. Me a day later, you a day just shy of it. So that's great, man. Well,
I'm sorry, Larry. The fatigue is getting to me, and I'm getting a little grouchy here. So,
uh-oh.
Mea culpa.
For what?
For making fun of how old you are.
Oh, okay. Well, that I'm used to that. You don't have to apologize for that. I'm 37. I'm not old. Actually, I'm older than 37, but that's okay.
You're not old, so it's okay.
I'm a spring chicken compared to most people in the conducting field. That's for sure. Okay, so speaking of conducting, that is ostensibly what this show is about. So our topic today. Oh, wait, I didn't talk about my brew, but that's probably a good thing. I'm just going to say I'm drinking decaf, and we'll leave it at that. So yeah, so you can make fun of me another time, Matt. When you're feeling more up to your up, I wouldn't want you to not have your full strength when you mock me for drinking my decaf.
You know, Larry, I have to say, Monday night when I got home from work about 5 p.m., I was dying for a cup of coffee. I felt like I was on another planet all day, and it was all I could do not to make myself a cup of coffee. What I would have given for a cup of decaf coffee at that point.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it has its uses. That's all I'm saying. So.
Well, that's very diplomatic of you. I look forward to being back in the yard with you so I can drink some good coffee again. So.
Oh, that reminds me. Matt.
Yeah.
McKeever gave me the Bold Stone Creek Voyage Space coffee. I can't remember the name of it. I don't have it with me here, but I made some in the siphon last week or yesterday. Oh, God, was it yesterday? It feels like a long time ago. It's delicious. I made it in the siphon for the first time yesterday, and it's really quite nice. It's well-rounded, I will say.
Very cool.
I'm looking forward to giving a more thorough review of that in the future.
Well, when we're back together, we can make that. Yeah.
You can bring your siphon, and we can make it at the same time.
Oh, with yes.
The same number of, you know, the same exact. I have a little kitchen scale. We can make exactly the same amount of coffee with the same amount of beans and do as controlled an experiment as possible.
Yes, we need
now
to be need to be scientific about this, and we should make sure we do it when we have some guests over and force it upon them to make them tell us which one is better. So, because it wouldn't be like us not to have a competition.
That sounds good. Yeah, I mean, if we don't have a blind test, then what good is it? You know.
Yeah.
Well, I volunteer for sure.
Okay. Well, when are you back in town, McKee?
Yeah. Where are you getting back from your undisclosed location in Milwaukee?
I come back fully in August.
Fully in, you can come back in pieces before then.
And yeah, right.
In August.
You can like send an arm back in July. What's going on?
Oh well, I can't send an arm. I need it to conduct, but
I just need one.
Maybe a leg.
Okay. All right.
Maybe a rib.
Okay.
Really bad like sound effects for all these awful puns.
I didn't invest in the sound effects package when I bought my editing software, so I may have to do that. But yes, sometime in August we'll have a proper welcoming home of Matt McKeever. Okay. Well, now let's get on to the topic of the show.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about music, I guess. So
let's do that.
People keep listening to the show.
Well, you know,
it's just us. Yeah.
Well, you know, who knows why they tune in? I'm sure it serves a lot for the coffee talk. Okay. So we're doing bucket list pieces today, bucket list pieces and pieces that we can't conduct enough. So basically just the pieces that really excite us and make us happy, and we crank the volume up on the radio when we're listening. So we're going to start with bucket list pieces first. Now, in this category, it doesn't have to be necessarily a piece you've never conducted. Maybe you have studied it or conducted it in part. And the reason I'm putting that caveat is on there is because I have rehearsed and done one of my bucket list pieces, but I haven't done a full performance of it. So I'm for, at least for myself, modifying the category thusly. So, yes, go ahead, McKeever.
Well, another question that I have and another caveat to this, I guess, is, you know, how in-depth are we getting when we're talking about bucket lists? Are we talking bucket list that is most likely attainable, or are we talking, like, bucket list that we probably will never conduct?
No,
like,
no limits.
No limits?
No limits.
All right.
No
right,
limits. That's the beauty of the bucket list. It's about aspiration. It's all aspirational. Right. Okay, I feel like I should have put that in the email before we started the show, but that's okay. Yeah, so McKeever, with that,
perfectly.
Since you raised your hand, McKeever, we're going to make you go first. Give us a bucket list piece.
All right, a big bucket list piece of mine, and this is, again, so far-fetched, you know, like way out of the realm that I think that I'll ever have the opportunity to do, would be Messiaen's Tarongalila.
Whoa, so tell us about it.
It's a 10-movement symphonic work that features solo piano and I think I'm going to get the name of it wrong, Ondas Martinon, you know, whatever that R2-D2 noise is.
Wait, what?
Yeah, basically like that, yeah. Kind of like it's not a theremin, but it's kind of sort of like a theremin. It's just, it is such a neat, a neat piece. It really does, for you know, the most part, just kind of sound like a lot of like spaceship things and alien, you know, sounds. But it's, you know, his way of kind of bringing his style of music to a less selective and academic audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a huge orchestra, and there was a time when I was living here in Milwaukee while I was doing my my master's, and you know, Milwaukee's not very far from Chicago, so I would frequent the Chicago Symphony as often as I possibly could with their $15 student tickets, and there was a 3-week like French festival that they were doing with Esa-Pekka Salonen conducting. And I had never seen him conduct before, and I really wanted to see him conduct. But the only date that worked was that date. I knew nothing about this piece. And, you know, it was programmed, I think, with the Ravel Piano Concerto in G and something else. But it was just a trip. I walked away from that concert just enlightened and so excited to learn more about Messiaen's music.
That's great. They I went to a Utah Symphony performance of the From the Canyons to the Stars not that long ago, or I think, I don't know, the pandemic is warping my sense of time, but it's amazing music. So you say it has theremin in it, is that what you said, or something like theremin?
It's something like theremin. Oh, okay. I think it's called like an Ondas Martinon. I'm not going to get the name of it correct.
Okay, that's right. Yeah.
So those who are, you know, more in the know of these newer, you know, instruments of that time, I think this piece was written in the 50s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So where they were kind of sort of starting to bring in more electronic and experimental instruments into the orchestra. It just has, you know, things like that.
It's that whole post-war modern kind of feel about it. Yeah, I think that era is really kind of fascinating with electronic music, you know, starting kind of with the RCA Mark II synthesizer and all the experimental stuff that happens with that. By the way, have either of you guys ever played a theremin? No, so I
have not.
It's actually quite difficult. At least it was for me. I went to the Robert Moog's studio. Well, he's passed away in 2005, but he worked out of in Asheville, and there's still a Moog facility there where they're making Moog synthesizers and theremins, and you can tour it if you're ever in Asheville, North Carolina. And I just saw you can play around with one of them. It's really kind of very fine, not fine tuned, but small movements make a big difference on that. So it's really kind of a hard thing to play, but man, is it fun and kind of cool, and they're not that expensive. So I'm thinking about getting a theremin and maybe rewriting the podcast theme for theremin, kind of like Star Trek, you know, beginning of Star Trek. Well, I can't use that. Now we're gonna stop. We're gonna have to get copyright infringement. We're gonna get sued, Matt. Oh, you can't sing too much.
I don't know what that was. That was just a series of pitches that I happened to string together.
Yeah, that was just Matt. Random. Like, it's the COVID. It's the vaccine, man. It's the vaccine.
I was reading about Tarangalila Symphony. I didn't realize it was written for the Boston Symphony. It was commissioned by Koussevitzky, and mm-hmm. Koussevitzky got sick, and Bernstein premiered it in 1949, which is kind of cool.
Oh, how about that? Well, that's very cool.
Wow.
Yeah, very cool. All right. Well, Manella, well, good starting us off with like some real aspirational coolness there. All right, Manella, what you got? Give us a bucket list.
This should come as no surprise to anybody, Mahler 9.
I was about to say, it has to be a Mahler.
Yeah. I could talk about this piece all day, but what I really find captivating about it is one thing, and that's its mysterious nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's been called so many different things. The first movement in particular, it's been called Farewell to Life. It's been called the composer's personal note, if you will, regarding his failing heart, and it's not really any of those things specifically, although if we were to call it something, we'd probably call it a farewell to youth. He's saying goodbye to his himself, I think, and his childish side. You know, maybe not forever, but sounds kind of like it. But what I find so another thing that I find so captivating about this musically is its cyclical nature, and it's just so hard to define in terms of what form it takes, and yet it works so well. And I remember when I was first learning this that I would listen to a recording of it. For a long time, I really, really enjoyed the Claudio Abbado recording with Lucerne Festival Orchestra because they really do it justice. It's just so good. Everything is so clear and so accurate, but also impactful. And that's kind of Abbado's hallmark, I would say. And of course, those Lucerne players are just superstars. They can literally do anything. And I always found myself listening and thinking, wow, how did we get to this place in the music? How did we get here? Its ideas, the movement's ideas really morph from one to another in a way that's so organic that it's hard to describe. There's a lot of interesting overlap between motivic areas and thematic material. And the way Mahler uses his materials is very, very efficient. So in a way, it feels like one thing that just has a set of variations that oscillate from being really, really happy to really, really tragic. And that is kind of the name of the game when it comes to Mahler. And I think he really gets everything right. Hmm. A lot of his other symphonies, it's hard for me to say that about. But I would say 6 and 7 are really close. And then there's 9. That first movement is just transcends a lot of things. It takes things to the next level in a way that I haven't really put my finger on yet. And then he does it again in the 10th symphony. The first movement of the 10th symphony is just like that as well. It's almost a continuation of the 9th symphony. So that's on my bucket list. It would have to be the right orchestra. The writing is fiendishly difficult. Not necessarily from a technical standpoint. It's a lot of it is difficult, but especially in the inner strings. Well, all the strings, frankly. You know, I take it back. Everybody. It's hard for everybody, but especially the string writing. It's so often not melodic. It's motivic, and it's stuff that's happening inside all the other action, if you will, that has to be brought out in a way that's really clear. And the rhythms make it difficult. There's just a lot happening. This constant movement, almost as if it's like a Richard Strauss tone poem. If that makes sense, that analogy makes sense, or that comparison makes sense. So I find it really challenging both to analyze and to study. And also I imagine it would be awfully difficult to know how to rehearse and to be able to perform it well. It's kind of a dream of mine to do at least the first movement. I mean, I would love to do the whole symphony, but really I love the first movement the most.
Yeah.
So that's my first bucket list piece there.
Absolutely. Can I ask you really quick, Matt? You may have a ready answer at this. If we were going to make like a smaller bucket, like a Mahler bucket, if you could rank them in order of your priority to do, how would you rank them, you think?
The symphonies or?
Yeah, the symphonies. Everything. Just the Mahler symphonies. That's what I said. It's a separate little Mahler bucket.
Okay. Yeah. Separate Mahler bucket. The 9th Symphony and Das Lied von der Erde are up there. Okay. Really, because Das Lied is like the 9th symphony, and the 9th symphony is really the 10th symphony, because he was superstitious like that. So he wrote an he wrote a named set of songs as his 9th symphony, and it's Das Lied, the Song of the Earth. But I'm also fascinated by the 7th. So 7 and 9 and Das Lied are all sort of in the same camp for me. 7, I love it because it's inscrutable in a way. Mm-hmm. Although it says so much, it also is dying for clarification. And I think it's that, ambiguity that, emotional ambiguity, musical ambiguity, both that, they're intertwined, I suppose, that makes it so interesting to me. I know a lot of people find it very challenging in terms of its content and just being able to enjoy it, but I've always found it one of the more fascinating works of his. So I really love 7, 9, the first movement of 10, then 6 is up there as well. 4, I think, is the best of the early symphonies by far. And I kind of like 1, 2, and 3. I really could do without, frankly. There's moments that I enjoy, but it's just such a monumental undertaking.
Oh, my gosh.
8. 8, I think, was sort of the perfection of what he tried to accomplish in 2. But it's still not quite as easy to to intuit, I think, than as the others. I mean, you have to know a lot about the texts that are being sung, and the Faust legend, and there's a lot to get that there's something about the abstract, the pure abstractness of non-vocal music that is really alluring in Mahler's hands, in my opinion.
Well, cool. All right. Very good. So, McKeever, did you have a comment on the Mahler? You were gesturing over there.
I was. You know, it's interesting. I find Mahler 7 to be exactly what Matt said, like really hard on some of the listeners. And I am one of those listeners that it's really hard on. It's just, to me, it seems like almost like an ADD sort of style symphony. It's like, it's Mahler's version of Sibelius in a way, you know?
When you say like ADD, like obsessive, like, or like, schizophrenic,
like very jumpy. Yeah. Jumpy to me. And to me, you know, sometimes there are Mahler symphonies where you get lost in the ethereal. And I feel like with that particular Mahler, I just get lost.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, very good. Well, I had figured that Mahler would come up soon when I had the Mats on the show, for sure. All right. I'm going to take us back to the 20th century for my first bucket list piece. It's John Adams' Grand Pianola Music. And I talked about on the podcast a while ago. It was a nerd moment early on. But it's one of my, I mean, I love John Adams' music, but it's really such a beautiful piece. And it reminds me of these, like, cityscapes, these almost futuristic cityscapes, like you're flying through a city and going through these buildings. I just get that feel from it. And it's a really monumental kind of work. I pulled my Daniels out to double check my instrumentation, but it has it's for three amplified female voices, a full set of winds, a full set of brass, three percussion, and then two pianos, no strings. It has just a really wonderful variety of timbres in it, and that minimalism where he makes those small shifts in timbre and other things just really paints a beautiful picture. And then the last section on the dominant divide is just really glorious, and just it kind of makes your heart swell. So I would love to do that. It's kind of odd forces, which means makes it kind of difficult to do. And that minimalism stuff, it's tough to play. It's tough to conduct, to catch all those changes and to really be there. I've done a little bit of it, and it's a lot of traffic copping, you know, like making sure people know where those changes happen so that they don't miss them. We're throwing it open to anything being possible. So there you go. That's my bucket list one.
I love Adams, and I almost picked an Adams. I almost picked the Chairman Dances, which I've done, mm-hmm. And I found it one of the hardest things to conduct ever. And yeah, for exactly the reason that you mentioned, which is it's minimalist, so there's really small changes that occur over vast stretches of time, and being able to catch those and to cue those moments for the musicians in a way that's holistic, for lack of a better word, is extremely difficult. I found, and also grand pianola music is, if memory serves, it's one of those kind of phasing type pieces, mm-hmm. where there's, like, again, those really small changes over time that have to be done seamlessly, that it sounds easy, but it's monumentally difficult to pull off, I think.
Yeah. And to keep it steady and to keep everything just clicking along.
Yeah. You also said something that I really related with, which was the cityscape sort of imagery. Mm-hmm. Every time I hear Adams' music, from the first moment I heard his music, which was Short Ride in a Fast Machine, the band arrangement of it, I had a very strong association with an image as well. And it was an image. It was an image of motion. It was a feeling of floating over the ground at high speed with no resistance whatsoever. You know, like not floating like an airplane or like Superman, but like literally just passing through space with things, you know, rushing by me at a very quick rate of speed. And I still feel that way when I hear a lot of his music, and it has something to do with the rhythmic impulse, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. There is sort of a quality about it that you can't quite necessarily put your finger on, but really, really does evoke, you know, quite evocative of images. That's why he's a great composer, because he can do that stuff. Okay, great. McKeever, give us another bucket. One in the bucket.
Another bucket list for me, and I think this one would be more attainable, but you have to sort of have, you know, the right soloist for the job, the Brahms Violin Concerto.
Hmm. Excellent. Yeah.
It is so powerful. And I got to do it once in a workshop. It was the first time that I had ever been with a soloist, like had conducted with a soloist and had an orchestra, you know, present as well. So it was this giant rush of sort of, you know, first time combinations, you know, first time that you're in front of an orchestra that doesn't necessarily need you and with a soloist that doesn't really need you. So you can kind of just be there to enjoy, but to also just help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of one of the why that piece is so great, especially, you know, for conductors as well, because they can sort of, you know, take a back seat a little bit. They have to shape a little bit, but it's one of those pieces that you just get to stand up and just really absorb all of the sounds.
Mm-hmm. Do you think,
so, assuming you don't screw it up, of course?
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel about comparing it in comparison to his symphonies in terms of, I'm obviously the conducting is different when you have a soloist, but is it the same kind of challenge that you would get with a Brahms symphony, do you think?
I don't think it is. Maybe a little bit in the first movement. But, you know, between, you know, he only wrote the four concerti. He wrote the violin concerto, the two piano concertos, and the double concerto for violin and cello. And I think it's the piece that's the most, I think, soloistic for the soloist. I think, you know, the two piano concertos really kind of in some way function as symphonies 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
There are soloistic moments, but I think as a whole, with the way the orchestration works and how everyone has to participate with each other, it's almost more like it's like a you know, piano sonata with an orchestral, I don't want to say accompaniment, but
did you mention the four movements?
Oh, of the second concerto?
Yeah, which makes it feel like a symphony, I think. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, they're monumental works. And
they are.
If I remember, did he write those both before his first symphony?
I believe he did.
Or was that just the Brahms the Requiem? He did write the Requiem first, but I think yeah, like his piano concertos, like, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but they're like practice symphonies.
Yeah, and same with the serenades. I mean, the serenades are also just glorious works that, you know, in comparison to his symphonies are a little pushed under the rug, but still, you know, function as really high quality early pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of the monumental, when I have conducted Brahms before, I felt like I just finished climbing a mountain. At the end of it, those things are massive. Okay, Manella, good second one there, McKeever. What you got, Manella?
Wait, which Brahms did you do, Larry? Which one felt like climbing a mountain?
Well, I did two and one, and those both felt like climbing a mountain. One was much more of a mountain.
Yeah, I was going to say the second one at least it's sort of like a beautiful sunnyscape. The first one is like, whoa, major issues. It's like doing Beethoven's Ninth because it's almost like doing Beethoven's Ninth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's intense. But I did two most recently. I did that with the youth orchestra a few years back.
That would be a bucket list piece for me. I forgot about that. Brahms too. I love the end. It's just so good.
Oh well.
Speaking of endings that I love.
Okay.
I've got Beethoven 7 here.
There you go.
Which I've done parts of before. I believe just the second movement, actually. Yes, just the funeral march.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to get the style right, but it is so I don't even have the words. This has been one of my favorite pieces ever since I can remember.
My favorite Beethoven.
Easily. Yeah. Especially, I mean, I'm not unique there, of course. It's just that good, that damn good. And to be able to study it intensively and develop the tools to be able to understand it more and more, mm-hmm. to just develop one's own ideas about how it could sound has been a real thrill. And this is a score that I keep coming back to again and again, just to look at it and to dig into it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Oh, Matt's got a copy over there too. Yeah.
Well, it's under every conductor's pillow, the Beethoven symphonies. Yeah. So you say you did the second movement before?
Yes.
Okay.
With the community group. Yep. Yeah. Actually, last year we didn't even get to perform it because COVID shut us down. But
I've done it before with community groups, and it's doable. It kind of depends on the level. The opening movement, that rhythm can get tricky. The first time I did it, I was kind of surprised at how much we had to struggle a bit with that. Getting the right bowings is, of course, crucial to that. But it's got some tricky spots. That's a wonderful symphony to do. I absolutely love it. It is my favorite Beethoven, without question, for sure. My next bucket.
What's your next?
My next one is Respighi, Pines of Rome.
Oh, yes. I just rehearsed a little bit of that this week.
Yeah. So are you going to do it somewhere?
No, I was giving a clinic with the Skyward Symphony in North Salt Lake. Oh. They're based out of Ogden, I believe, or maybe not. I'm not sure. Anyway, it's a community group run by a wonderful guy named Jonathan Nish, mm-hmm. who is the founding director, and it's his baby, and he's got a full group that has begun meeting in the gymnasium again. Mm. And they're doing a big concert in a couple weeks, and including an arrangement of the finale of Pines of Rome, the Pines of the Appian Way, I believe. Is that the last one?
Yep, that's the last one. And I've rehearsed this one before. We did it when I was in graduate school. The youth orchestra did it. I didn't conduct it. I just, covered some rehearsals for it. So I have worked it up, but I've actually never found the opportunity to perform the whole thing myself. I've gotten tantalizingly close, but
It has tricky moments.
It has tricky moments. You have to have real solid soloists. You have to have the extra brass at the end. You have to have a recording of a bird song. I mean, not that that's hard to get, but it's a bit of a do, but it's more attainable, I should say, than the grand pianola music. I'll put it that way. So I think I can actually maybe get this one out of the bucket. But that's one that's been kind of burning a hole in my pocket, to do. And it's just, I mean, I love that, that, Respighi's, his style, that kind of early 20th century, impressionism. Just the imagery that he can evoke with that. And of course, the ending, I'm a brass player, so the ending is just, brass, just, going for it. So, and I always have these like theatrical ideas of what to do with the brass. I see people in togas and stuff like that marching around with like the banners. No, I'm just kidding. That's a little more theatrical than
I could probably pull it off. But you might want to consider like centurion outfits instead of mere togas or something.
Oh, okay. Well, it's Roman legions, right? I would wear a toga. I actually have a Roman senator's toga that I had for a costume from years ago. So I could pull that out and wear that.
I think I've got one also. We could have a toga day.
Hey,
toga.
We almost got a quorum. We could have our own Senate. There you go. All right. Sounds good. The Avenue Senate. So anyway, Pines of
the
Rome.
Avenue Senatus Populusque.
Yeah, I don't know how to spell that. Okay, but yeah, Pines of Rome is definitely up there. Love to do all of them. Okay, let's do one more bucket list, and then I want to move on to pieces that we just love doing. So, McKeever, what's your final bucket list?
Final bucket list is something that I've also had the opportunity to rehearse, but would love to perform someday. And that's, my favorite of all time, Copland's Third Symphony. I know Matt's just putting his hand on his head.
It's not because he's not feeling well either. Okay.
Well, maybe Copland to make him sick.
I didn't say anything. I haven't said anything.
I don't know. There's just something about this piece that I find so exciting every single time that I hear it. And being able to actually be in front of a group and see just how challenging it is to put together. I mean, it is, I think it's underrated in terms of its difficulty. You know, it may not have the same sort of metronomic, complications that the Rite of Spring does, but for the instrumentalists, you know, they have to do these athletic leaps on all parts of the instruments, and all the instruments have these just insane ranges that they have to play in. And just to bring it to its full spectrum, I think is so cool to see. And if, you know, for someone to have like just a very clear vision from start to finish, I think it's a really great work and just a real big piece of art.
All right. I'm just going to let Matt talk. Go ahead, Matt. Counterpoint.
I disagree, but counterpoint. I'm in no position to argue.
Oh, okay. All right. He's going to.
Yeah, right, I mean, you like what you like, right? You know, I respect that. There's no disputing that, you know, taste will differ. Here's my third bucket list. Ravel.
Okay.
Daphnis and Chloe.
Oh, okay. Very good.
The whole thing.
Whole thing.
Yeah, not just the suite.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
The whole
bloody thing.
Cool. Yeah.
No, I love the sunrise, and it's if ever there was a consummate orchestrator, it was Ravel, right? That we don't have to. I think that's pretty much agreeable. But this piece in particular, the way the orchestra is used, it gives a conductor so many opportunities to affect the sound, and that's a challenge, and also a big privilege, it's like a huge dopamine hit to the brain. I think like that would be something I always imagine whenever I hear it. I'm like, oh, I would give anything to be on the podium doing this right now.
There you go.
And that's, yeah. I mean, most music honestly is like that, but only when I'm watching somebody else conduct. Daphnis, it's like, no, I want to get up there and do it every time I hear it. From the first measure to the very, very end, I think every part of it is perfect.
It's one of those pieces that's a real test of trust between you and your ensemble. You know, to get the vision right, to get the sound right. I mean, I've never done it. I've seen it done a couple of times, but I'm right there with you that it's so extraordinary in the imagery that it really brings out.
Yeah. I've never done any part of it, so, but I know what you mean about that, which with that quality of Ravel's music. Yeah, it's kind of in that similar feel for me for the Respighi, that kind of impressionistic feeling. Okay, my final bucket list one, Enigma Variations. Again, done parts of this and prepped up and rehearsed probably all of it, and at some point, because we did it at the U when I was as a graduate student, but I've never performed the whole thing. I've done Nimrod a few times, which works great by itself.
Great stuff.
It is. I just absolutely adore Elgar. I just did his Serenade for Strings not that long ago with my Wasatch Symphony Orchestra.
Larry, how do you feel about the style of playing, the British style of string playing in particular? Have you heard the Elgar conducting recording?
No, I don't believe I have.
Well, you're going to love that. Well, okay. We need to have an Enigma Variations show, I think.
Okay.
This is going to blow your mind, I feel. So the first time I listened to this, actually, this was for an audition at the U, at the University of Utah.
You auditioned the year we did this.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. And I, you know, doing my research, of course, in the course of that, I came across this recording of Elgar conducting, I believe, I'm doubting myself in my addled state, but I believe it was Elgar conducting his own music. And I believe it was the BBC Philharmonic or London Symphony. It was a British orchestra, and they were playing all the notes. And I'm thinking of the violins, first violins in particular. They were playing all these notes connected, like major sliding going on between like almost everything. And I had to look it up because I thought, how odd. I've never heard this sort of style or approach to playing British music. And it turns out it was a very, very common aesthetic choice at that time to add a lot of, it's either portamento or portato. I can never remember the right word. But it's that sliding, the connection between, you know, da 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 da, ee, da da da. Mm-hmm. Yeah, da, da. It's almost like a drunk grandfather stumbling home singing to himself. An approach to playing the violin.
All right.
But it's incredibly effective, and it adds a lot and it changes a lot. And his tempos are really revealing too. So let's check that out at some point. I'd love to talk more about
we've already programmed another show. We'll save any further discussion of the Elgar for a later show. Unless McKeever, you got a quick comment. Did you okay? All right, we're good. So let's move on to pieces that we just can't conduct enough. Our constant go-tos, and for me, these are pieces that I'm constantly figuring out how long ago did I do it? Can I program it again without annoying people? So that's kind of my standard for this. So let's start with you, McKeever. What do you got?
I'm probably going to make Matt shake his head again, which
well,
is
that's
fine.
Why we program you here.
But, you know, to me, if someone said that you could only, like, really conduct one thing for the rest of your life, it would have to be the 13-instrument version of Appalachian Spring.
Oh, that's a good choice. That's a good choice.
I've had the opportunity to conduct it only once in performance, but I've rehearsed it a few times, and it's just one of those scores that once you really get it in your hands, you can just – it's like the Brahms. You can just stand in front of the ensemble and just enjoy the sounds. You know, that piece is a great conducting training piece for those who are, you know, learning how to conduct and really learning to conduct mixed meter, and for those who need a smaller ensemble to, you know, pardon my old age here, but to get good tape.
Hey, I still call it tape, but I am old. I'm older than you.
You are. But I still use tape, you know, at some point in my life. But it's just one of those pieces that just really kind of sort of sticks with you and I think has a really nice aging process for when you're able to revisit it. You know, you're not going to do it the same way every time, but I think every time you are able to come back to a piece, you find things that are just clearer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I love this piece so much.
And you know, it may be a heresy to say this, but I like the smaller instrumentation version. I love the piano part. Yeah.
I concur. I was actually on the radio. I was not on the radio. I was listening to the radio.
Hey, you're on the radio the right day, now, man.
And it was the full orchestra version. I thought, oh, just the 13-instrument version is so much more intimate and enjoyable, I find. So I agree. Honestly, if I had to pick a piece to listen to by Copland, it might be that one. Mm. It wouldn't be for the common man, that's for sure. But it might be that one.
It's your gateway.
Honestly, I like Rodeo a lot. I like.
Yeah, Rodeo's good. The Tenderland. I like the.
Oh, the opera. Too. Yeah. Yeah. Promise of giving, something like that.
Promise of living.
Promise of living, something about giving. Okay. Yeah, I like the Tenderland. That's a good one. Okay, good. Manella, what's your give us a piece?
Okay. I've got two, and I'll give you, I guess, my favorite one. No, it's hard to pick. Beethoven Egmont Overture.
Oh, you stole it. That's on the top of my stack right there. You man.
So good.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll talk
about it. It's what I get for being nice and letting other people go first.
Well, you know what? I mean, I'll let you have it.
No. It's yours. You go. Go for it. Talk.
No, I mean, there's not much I can say about it other than – not much that comes to mind now other than how awesome the beginning is, and also how awesome the end is, and how awesome the middle is, and it's just awesome. It's just a great nugget of awesomeness of Beethoven.
And it is a nugget. It's compact, but it's like all of that Beethoven intensity compact into a relatively short overture, and so you get all the great Beethoven energy.
You know what it is for me. This is totally a figment of my imagination, but this is another one that I've from a very early age associated with that German Germanic Viennese grandiosity, but simplicity and just the sound of the orchestra in this piece, especially that first chord. The sound is like, well, no, it's not even a chord. It's just what, unison E, I think.
I think it's F.
F. Hang on, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, F.
Oh, it's a C. No, I'm looking at the wrong piece. Hang on, that's Coriolan. That's another good one, though. All right, whatever Matt said. Yeah, if it's an F,
it's great. A bunch of Fs. I'm seeing a bunch of Fs.
Yeah, that first note, it's like, it sounds so thin somehow. And I guess it's just because it's an F. But as it continues, of course, you get more and more of a sense of just the royal feel of the music, and not much gets my heart racing like the finale of that overture.
Yeah, but before we leave the opening, I got to say the silence. But after in this measure two, after the second half note, right before the eighth note, bum, bum, and that silence that just seems to go on forever until you come in with the next chord. That just builds so much intensity. That's silence is so important in music because it when you have an intense silence like that, it just makes what follows it just that much more impactful. I don't know. I just that silence, and given that pickup note to the second or to the third measure is just, it's one of my favorite things to do in this whole piece.
Yeah. You know,
it's also hard.
Yeah.
I love the transition going from the slow to the fast. And the reason I love it is once you have a way to actually do it and convey it to the orchestra, and the orchestra just really follows, it's one of those things that's so practiced. And I don't want to say that it doesn't need to be practiced, but maybe it's just my way of saying I found a really good trick of how to
connect. Well, how do you do it? Save all those kids at workshops some time.
I literally just have to give two beats. You give the downbeat of the first measure, and then you give the downbeat of the second measure. And from then, they can get the tempo of the whole thing. You know, if you just give and it doesn't spiral, but as long as you give them the first two measures in one, you have where they the rest to place, the next note, and then it's the first of the restarts. I think it's the only restart that's actually on the next downbeat, just so they know they're in the right place.
Yeah. Just the business.
And I don't know, the first time that I ever did this, I actually have a really funny story about this. The first time that I actually did this in a performance setting, I knew the piece well enough that I didn't bring a score out. I did this and I did the Mendelssohn Scottish Symphony on the same program. So I just had my Mendelssohn score out there, and the person who was playing concertmaster, as I walked on stage, like, was almost freaking out and was trying to get my attention before I started conducting, because I walked out, the audience started clapping, gave the handshake, and then we were going to go, and she was going to let me know, hey, you don't have your Beethoven score. And I just thought in my head, correct.
Did it from memory? Did it from memory?
I did.
There you go. Well, there's a lot of work in there, but I've actually never done it from memory. I probably could at this point, but I don't know. I like having my score there. It makes me feel comfortable. And this ending, Matt, Manella, you were talking about this ending. This big buildup around 287, the Allegro con brio, and then this great horn entrance and this all the brass coming in. Oh my gosh. That's one of my favorite cues to give in all of music. It's just let it rip.
For me, what makes this work is the strings, the violins, actually, they have to play their 16ths like it's the melody. Otherwise, it's just boring for me.
What do you mean by play it like the melody?
Sure. I mean, the 16th notes.
That part.
Yeah, it's they're playing the same thing as the winds and the brass, but it's instead of long notes and eighth notes, they have all 16th notes.
So maybe like
that's all I mean is they have to know that they're playing a melody and not it looks rhythmic, but it's actually just like metered tremolo.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, I thought you were talking about the 16th notes in the right at the beginning of the Allegro con brio, but absolutely, like, so they need to bring out those last groupings, to shape that line to go into the next measure. So yeah, I totally know what you mean with that, and to know that they are important.
You go ahead.
No, I was ready for you. Go for it.
I also love the horns. The horns have the first note of each of those four notes groups, and it's just held a little bit longer, as indicated by the dotted quarter note.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful effect. It's like this sort of like schmear kind of echo going on. And I was always fascinated by that when I heard this recording of this piece long, long ago.
Yeah.
I don't know why. You know, I think a lot of what I'm coming to now is that my favorite pieces are my favorite pieces because I feel nostalgic about them in some way.
Yeah. You know, and that's all right. And Matt, that happens when you get old, just so you know.
Since this is all about circle.
This is all about,
I appreciate that. Thanks for the advice, old man.
Because you're going to get there someday, kiddo. Don't worry about that.
Well, I feel old, that's for sure.
Yeah. I you know.
An interesting point. This is a great example of, do you have the trumpets play higher or do you have them play as written? Mm. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
Bum bum bum.
Yes.
Bum bum.
I've seen orchestras do it both ways, where the trumpets are they're an F, mm-hmm. and they have a written C E G on the top of the staff, which it's actually not written that way. That's what the music is, that ascending triad, but they Beethoven scores them to go down the octave
to the G low, the lower G.
Yeah, to play the lower G, because that G in the F trumpet maybe was somewhat unreliable. It's a high note. It's concert C. But I've seen orchestras do it where they have, you know, one of the section members has a really great high range and they're comfortable doing it. And so they'll play principal. There'll be assigned principal on that piece. And that was in Atlanta. When I was in Georgia, I saw Atlanta do that, and they played it, and the woman playing principal just nailed those glorious high C's. It was just fantastic.
I did actually ask for that one time. I had a principal who did it. Yeah, it was great. So anyway, yeah, I generally don't like to recompose, and that's kind of a similar to, what is it, the end of the Beethoven Symphony 3, where sometimes people recompose
the
trumpet line.
First movement, yeah.
First movement, not the last one.
Do mi do so, do mi so so.
Yeah, that part, right. Yeah. I try not to do that, but sometimes it's oh so tempting. Okay, good. Well, that was actually your bucket list one, so I'm actually going to take a turn here. Since you stole mine, I'm going to stick with overtures and do Rosamunde Overture by Schubert. I absolutely adore this one, and I kind of find it goes well with the unfinished symphony. I don't pretend to finish it with this, but, you know, if you program the unfinished symphony and then you program this after, it kind of makes for a nice conclusion.
You know, I thought about programming it when I did the great C major, since the Rosamunde Overture is also in C major. And then I've also considered pairing it with Brahms 1, because both of those, because I think the Rosamunde Overture has the same instrumentation, at least I think for the great C major symphony. And then with, you know, with Brahms 1, you need to add your piccolo and your contra bassoon, but you'll have the three horns. Mm-hmm. Three trombones. And I'm actually now thinking that I might have screwed this up in the instrumentation. Does it call for two horns or does it call for four horns?
It has four horns.
It has four horns.
Rosamund has four horns.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're in one of those predicaments where you're doing like a piece that is kind of maybe like, you know, Beethoven 5 or Beethoven 9 or Schumann 3, where your trombones might not have a whole lot to do. I think this is a quick and dirty overture to put on to give them, you know, a little more playing time.
Yeah, no, it's good. And as a trombone player, I appreciate a little more playing time.
And I like that it reminds me a lot of, now I can't remember which piece it is, that doesn't have a development section. It's just kind of, you know, the exposition just twice, but then the exposition doesn't modulate the second time.
I don't know. I think you're right about that. We just have the second section. That's the second section. And then bum bugadum bugadum bum 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 bugadum bugadum. And then back to the opening. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of like doing it's kind of like doing a sonata form thing without a development.
Never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
Okay, well there you go. Well, thanks for bringing a little theory to the party here.
Is McKeever. It really a sonata form then?
Well, No. Don't even start this. Don't stop right there. Okay. We're moving on from Rosamunda. I had one more thing I wanted to say about this, but I can't remember what it was. What I was going to say is I love the tunes. Schubert is just, he's the tune guy. And the tunes in here are just really, they're fun and they're sweet. In the beginning, it's just very pleasant. It just makes me happy. Okay. Anyway, so that's Rosamunda. All right, McKeever, number two. What's your next one?
Oh, my next one definitely has to be Dvorak 8.
I agree with that.
You know, it's just party music.
It is party music.
You know, I have some nostalgia to it. It's the first piece that I actually ever got to conduct twice in performance ever. And I just think that it's such a well-written piece. It uses all the instruments that you need to have on there in a way that makes everything really interesting for all the instrumentalists on stage. You know, Dvorak 9, he does use tuba, but at what cost? And he uses extra percussion, but at what cost? You know, he doesn't need to bring in other instruments to add just a little sparkle and flair here and there. He uses all the instruments of what they need to do in the time they need to do it. And I mean, that last movement is just so much fun to conduct and to get the pacing.
Oh my gosh.
From just how bombastic it goes. And, you know, you can really just kind of bring the energy down and make the audience think, oh, we're just going to, you know, have a very quick little nap. And then, nope, you just get right back into the final bit of the party music. I mean, it's just so much fun.
It really is. And that ending, oh my gosh. Just so cool. Very, very intense. Just kind of
and
explodes.
One of the most beautiful second movements ever.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it really does. I mean, the second movement of the New World is pretty amazing too, but
yeah,
that's just glorious. Okay. Yep. Okay, Manella, what you got?
Debussy.
Ah. Fawn. I'm sorry. What was that? Debussy what?
Fawn.
Oh, Fawn. Yeah.
Prelude to the Afternoon of a Fawn.
Don't play that right now. You might go to sleep.
I'm looking at the score and it's happening.
you're on low power as it is. Don't. That's just going to put you over the edge.
I'm just obsessed with this piece. Yeah, I did this a few years ago and haven't had the chance since, but I think it's one of those pieces. Well, every piece is like this, where you do it and you think, ah, if I could do it again right now, I'd do it differently. Mm-hmm. And I'm always thinking, oh man, I really want to try this or I want to try that. There's so many opportunities to read between the lines in this piece and to pull out things that are there that you rarely hear, and to mess with tempos a lot, because it's not always clear what the tempo should be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I have no explanation for that other than to say, when you hear a recording that works, you know it works. And when you hear a recording that doesn't work, you know it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Although, again, taste is subjective. So I have very strong opinions about how it should be done, of course. But
yes.
Like, it shouldn't be too slow, for instance. Mm-hmm. That it should flow more. And that all the dynamic shifts should be really subtle, but also impactful.
Yeah.
And, well, in particular, the tempo. I mean, the beginning, you know, very moderately, but it's marked very moderately. But it also can't be like completely timeless. It has a rhythmic pattern that I want to be heard. And Debussy builds in spaces for there to be this sort of timelessness, especially the bar of silence at measure six, mm-hmm. which is just six eighth note beats of not nothing, but of silence.
Yeah,
following
no,
that silence. Opening, you know, the fawn is waking up. And I love sort of messing with that, the psychology of that in a way, because it's like, I want to put the audience to sleep, but I also don't want to put them to sleep. So it's like a fine line to walk.
You want to cast a spell on them.
Yes, we're casting a Larry spell.
No, that's not a Larry spell. Definitely not. Excellent choice. I've never done the fawn, so I've got to put that
up. I also haven't.
All right. We'll have to add that to my list. Okay, good. Excellent choice. All right. For my next one, I am going to choose Corellia Overture, Sibelius. It started with, okay, I don't want to do Finlandia again, which I do like. I like Finlandia, but I did that too much. And I'm like, I need something else, something Sibelius. And I discovered this gem, and it's just a wonderful little piece. It is not hard to play. It's not that hard. It's got beautiful folk tune-like stuff in there. It's got a similar structure to Finlandia. Not exactly, of course, but kind of similar. It's just charming and delightful, you know. Anyway, and it gives a lot of different things for of different parts of the orchestra to do. So,
the first time that I ever heard that was actually because you asked me to come and sub for your orchestra that one day, and I had done the suite mm-hmm. in rehearsal, I think two or three times with the Campus Symphony as we were getting ready to perform that. You know, the Corellia suite, I guess, for me is like the piece that I'd consider that I've done so many times in rehearsal, but I've never performed. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like cursed in that way. But the Corellia Overture was such a refreshing thing to do from doing the suite.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people do the suite. I mean, I hear about that more, but I just don't think when I just talk to composers or conductors, they're like, oh, I've never done that before. It just doesn't get enough play for some reason. But anyway, I'm on a mission to promote the Corellia Overture. And like I said, it's really doable student community groups. So there you go. I don't have any like promotional fees paid to me by the Sibelius Estate or any publishers. I'm just evangelizing for the Corellia Overture on my own. Okay, last one, last round, McKeever, what do you got?
You know, it's already been talked about, but I'm going to talk about it again since it is a piece that I've done once. And if I can conduct it again, you know, a million times, I'd love to do it, is Brahms 2. It's just so cool. You know, the writing, and I've done so much study on this one. I had to do it for an audition one time, and I went through the first movement and did this. I can show you on this screen here, this really ridiculous analysis of like a,
wow.
You know, a bar by, not a bar by bar, but a phrase by phrase thing, mm-hmm. you know, like what to pay attention to, what changes, what key are we in, who enters, you know, and you know, from the get-go of this piece, we're really in sort of a, I don't want to say like a contradictory state of where we put our phrasing, but you know the real tune begins with this, with the horns doing the da 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 da, da. But it's always interrupted with this da da dum ba da dum ba da dum. I don't know. It's just it, to see how many times that, you know, half step motive just appears, not throughout the entire first movement, but the entire symphony is amazing. And as Matt said, you know, the finale and especially that ending, if you get the right trombones to just, you know, blast their little hearts out at that very end, it's as close to a religious experience as I think I'll ever have.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I, having done it, I'm right there with you, man. I am right there with you. Anyway, and I love the second movement of that. It's just
likewise.
Yeah, that's actually the first I conducted that in a workshop years ago. Just that second movement, and so I don't know. That's very special, and that's and then when I got to do the whole thing, of course, you know, really discovered the beauty of the entire thing, of course. But yeah, it's it, you know, 1 and 4 get so much attention with Brahms. I think those middle two, just, you know, they're all gems. I mean, of course, they're all gems. Okay, Manella, what's your final one?
Well, this is both a bucket list piece and a desert island piece.
Okay.
I haven't done it, but I've imagined doing it.
Okay.
And it's Richard Strauss, Don Juan.
Ah, Don Juan. All right. Yeah. Very cool.
I think it's great. I think it's his best tone poem.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, it's short and sweet, relatively speaking. It has so many great moments that are just so colorful and vivid that I can't help but, you know, identify and relate with them. So which is what makes great music fun, I think, is it's relatable. So that's my last piece is Don Juan.
Don Juan. Have you done any of the Strauss tone poems?
Oof. I don't think so.
Mm.
No.
Yeah. I think you'd remember
that. Also have not.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but yeah, that's, I mean, those are ones that are challenging for like a lot of student and community groups that I've been working mostly with. So, I haven't either. Okay, good. So my final one is also a tone poem, but it's Smetana. Me and my Smetana thing. I got this thing for Smetana. I've been to Prague and left a piece of myself there and will always be there. All right. But this is not the Smetana you're thinking of. When I say, what Smetana tone poem? What do you think I got in the stack?
The Moldau.
Incorrect. Incorrect, gentlemen. It is not. I love the Moldau, or as they say in Prague, the Vltava. I think it's how you say it. The Moldau, that's the German word. Come on, let's be patriotic. It's Czech nationalistic music. We should use the Czech word for it. Come on. All right, you're good. Good thing I'm not there.
Thanks
in person.
Thanks for educating, Larry.
What'd you say?
Thank you for educating us.
Well, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to listen to your elders, okay? But no, there's 6 tone poems in Mavlost, and the first one, Vysharad, is my favorite. Well, it's my favorite to conduct. I like them all for different reasons, but this one is such a great one to conduct. First of all, it's not nearly as difficult as some of the other ones. Vltava or Moldau got some nasty work for the strings. I've done that one before as well. But it's doable. But this one is not so bad. So that's one of the reasons I like to come back to it. I've done it a few times. And also, if you happen to have access to 2 harp players, which I have fortunately had at several points in my careers with orchestras, it's got this great harp opening that is just really gorgeous. And then it cycles through a lot of different moods. It's all about life at this ancient Bohemian castle. Vysharad is the castle where the old Bohemian kings were. And the ruins are now a cemetery. It's where Smetana and Dvorak are buried, by the way. But it tells the story about life at the castle. And it has these really fun, intense little episodes all throughout. So there's a lot of action. It feels like there's a lot of action in this tone poem. And it's just, a lot of fun to conduct. It's got great little tunes, and again, good moments for some talented student harp players for sure. Okay, so there you go. That's my last one. Smetana, the unexpected Smetana.
There was an honorable mention in mine, and your poster in the background reminded me of it. The Amal and the Night Visitors.
Oh yes,
you know it is honestly like one of the most adorable things I think that is out there for us musicians, and I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to actually do that one in performance in December.
Yeah, it's a good show to do. I really thoroughly enjoyed doing it, and it's only an hour, so it's not a ton of work to put in for doing an opera.
Absolutely,
so, made for TV, so they had to keep it in under that hour mark. All right, well, gentlemen, thank you so much. This has been really fun, Matt. We're gonna end the show with a quick rant.
Yeah, what's going on with the weather? I am ready for spring. We had a couple of weeks of just gorgeous weather up in the 60s and 70s and sunny, and we didn't even have allergies because things hadn't bloomed yet. And now it's like 35 and 40 degrees, and it was snowing earlier, and now we're supposed to get thunderstorms this afternoon, and it's going to be in the 30s all night this week, and I'm just like, I'm over it. I want spring weather. That's my rant.
That's a good rant, and it is. It's just insane. Like I said, like we started the show. It's been... you know, it's springtime. Although I got to say, I still got a neighbor who's got Christmas lights up, like not just like I have like red Christmas lights on my balcony just for, you know, ambiance.
You want to ring the door or something, make sure they're alive.
They do this every year. This is a little bit longer than usual, but I just think they have forget that they're up.
So. They get to the point eventually where they just leave them up all year. It's, you know, we have Christmas every year.
It's getting close, but you know, they got snowflakes hanging from their house still, but it snowed today in their defense. So, okay. Maybe they'll take it down after today.
Maybe they're the cause of the snow.
There you go. That's right. Take your decorations down so we can finally have some warm weather.
Take their snowflakes. Yeah. They're sending bad energy out there.
All right.
We need the rain. We really, really, really need the moisture. So
yeah,
I'm ready to fast forward to warmer weather. That is all.
I feel
if we had another 30 degrees out there today, it'd be perfect.
Yeah, well, indeed. And it'd be almost twice as warm than it is right now. Okay, well, gentlemen, thanks so much for another great show. This was a fun one. I'm glad we did this. And we will do it again next week. So thank you so much for tuning in to Conductor's Brew. And we'll see you soon. Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Cheers.
Cheers.